Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up Senate Judiciary for this day, Wednesday, the 8th of April. A couple of formalities I want to take care of. We have a number of bills that are scheduled. First of all of the bills that are scheduled, none of the bills can move forward in the sense of out of committee because we do not have all the paperwork. So what we will be doing today is taking the various bills. Someone will be carried over. We have our fiscal advisor has been out ill, and so we're going to just have to wait for that stuff to come forward. I will tell everyone, if you're here on Senate Bill 481, that one is being pulled from the docket, and the reason it's pulled from the agenda is there's a companion bill or another bill that's on the House side that apparently has been the vehicle of choice. And so the topics that were going to be covered under 481 have been incorporated into that House bill, and our committee will deal with that once it comes over from the House. So understanding it's still there unless it got voted out yesterday. I will let everyone know on Senate Bill 87, which is on the top of our agenda, because the paperwork is not here, it is going to be carried over again. I'm going to set this for this Friday, which will be April 10th. So Senate Bill 87 will be carried over until Friday, April 10th. And with that, I think, Council, is there anything else in the formalities we need to take care of?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our first public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 296.
Senate Bill 296 requires a court to inform the jury of certain mandatory minimum sentences prior to deliberation.
All right, and with this, what I'm going to do is I want to call a panel up. Representative Shields, if you'll please come up. And I believe Roy Pulvers is going to be part of this panel. And Susan Reese and Mark Blackman. And then I also have Ms. Nunley, who's on the phone, but she won't need to have a chair at the dais.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I'm state representative for District 43 in North and Northeast Portland. I appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 296 today. And as counsel mentioned, Senate Bill 296 requires the court to inform jurors of the likely sentence in mandatory minimum cases prior to their deliberation. Now, in these mandatory sentencing cases, judges no longer define the punishment. The legislature and the voters have already done so. And we submit that providing this public information about the likely sentence will complement the jurors' pursuit of justice. As someone who has spent most of my adult life working near the criminal justice system, I truly believe that most of the time the DAs and law enforcement get it right. But sometimes they don't, and that's why we need due process. That's why we need checks and balances on the power of the state. District attorneys have recognized that sometimes the sentencing in mandatory cases gets wrong, and is particularly so if, and this is my view, if the defendant asserts his or her right to trial under the Sixth Amendment rather than taking the state's plea bargain offer. The example that everyone is talking about is State v. Rodriguez, wherein Ms. Rodriguez, according to Willamette Week, was sentenced to over 6 years for holding a boy's head to her chest. They've recognized that these cases can get out of hand, and in the House, it's been proposed a downward departure plan to address these type of situations. Now, downward departure is one way of addressing the problem. This bill is another. This approach puts power in the hands of jurors. It puts information about the likely sentence in mandatory sentencing cases, information that is already public, into their hands. And giving this public information would act as a check and balance on the charging and prosecutorial power and discretion of the state, because it would give a deputy DA incentive to use their charging discretion wisely, so that they charge a case in proportion to the severity of the crime, knowing that at the end of the day, they would have to look 12 jurors in the eye and tell them that in this case, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the sentence really does fit the crime. in the Rodriguez case, and I think you're getting a handout from Mr. Hintz, a former Tiger police officer who's now an investigator, that gives you more information around that case. In the Rodriguez case, I think it really would have helped them in their deliberation. An additional aspect of this bill is that I believe it will add some additional balance to the plea bargain negotiation process. Mr. Chair, this bill is about trusting juries with information that is public information. It's about checks and balances and making sure that sentences are proportionate to the crime. I think this is a very reasonable bill. And I'd like to introduce our panel, if I might now, Mr. Chair. To my left is Mr. Roy Pulvers, who will discuss the constitutional issues of the bill. Mr. Pulvers is a lawyer in private practice in Portland. He's served for 8 years as a staff attorney to the Oregon Supreme Court. For 10 years, he was an adjunct professor of law at Lewis and Clark, teaching state constitutional law. Articles include the Oregon Law Review on separation of powers under the Oregon Constitution. So I will step to the other chair and let Mr. Pulvers continue with his testimony. By the way, in identifying the others just momentarily, by phone we will hear from Pam Noonley, juror 636, in a case similar to the Rodriguez case in the scope of its disproportionality in the sentencing. She'll talk of how she would have been able to be a better juror with having had this information ahead of time. We'll hear from experienced law practitioners Susan Reese and Mark Blackman, attorneys in private practice. All the attorneys will discuss why this information is most useful for mandatory sentencing cases as opposed to others, and they will also discuss why giving information on criminal history to juries is materially different than giving public information on a likely sentence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senators, thank you very much. My name is Roy Pulvers, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 296. I do not practice criminal law, and I'm here to testify as someone who is knowledgeable about state constitutional law and as someone who thinks Senate Bill 296 is a very good idea. At this time in the law, the jury is instructed by the judge about the sentencing consequences of its verdict in two contexts. One is in a death penalty case, where in the voir dire, that is when the jury is being selected, in the guilt phase, that is the first phase of a death penalty trial, when the jury is making its determination as to the whether or not to convict of a crime and what crime to convict of, the judge instructs the jury about the potential consequences of an aggravated murder verdict, and likewise in a case where a defendant has pleaded guilty except for insanity, after the conclusion of the case and before the jury retires, the judge instructs the jury about the sentencing consequences of the jury making that determination, that is sentencing to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. This bill would amend that law and add crimes that carry a mandatory minimum sentence to that list. This is entirely consistent, in my view, with the judge's role in instructing the jury as to the law. That's precisely what the judge would be doing. It also takes account of three very important recent developments in the law more generally. First of all, it takes account of the historical fact that the major reason jurors were not told of the sentencing consequences of a guilty verdict was the fact that the legislature had placed in the hands of judges the decision as to the sentence to impose within very broad ranges as a general matter. Judges were given broad sentencing discretion. That's historically been the case for nearly 200 years in this country. Starting in the 1960s, and largely in New York with mandatory minimum sentences for drug cases, which they incidentally now are dismantling, there's been a movement of which Oregon has been a part to add mandatory minimum sentences to the overall sort of puzzle that is the criminal law. And with that, the legislature and the people have moved the authority, the sentencing authority, they have effectively moved it from judges to juries. It is now the case that when a jury makes a decision in a mandatory minimum case, we know that there is a mandatory minimum sentence that will be imposed pursuant to the law. So this bill takes account of that fact and the fact that everyone in the process, that is the judges, the defendant, the prosecutor, the victims, the public, everybody in the process knows the consequences except the jury. And that's only the jury in some cases, because in many instances, certain people on the jury, whether they're lawyers or not, will know that there is a mandatory minimum sentence that applies. So you have the embarrassing situation of having certain juries that know precisely what they're doing with respect to their sentence and others that do not, and what their authority is in the one instance and not in the other. It's also secondly consistent with the direction that the United States Supreme Court has taken in sentencing. It is moving more and more towards recognizing the importance of the jury's role in sentencing decisions, specifically with respect to finding facts that pertain to sentencing determinations. And finally, the third thing, it is consistent with the transparency of the judicial process that's been a part of Oregon law since its inception, with the open courts provision of the Oregon State Constitution, but also more recently with, for example, the insertion of the victims into the criminal justice process. So the move toward transparency and the faith in the citizens of the state to act responsibly under the law all are entirely consistent with the judge simply instructing the jury on the law in these cases. The last thing I would mention in passing is that this is not jury nullification. This is, to the contrary, this is the judge instructing the jury as to the law, which is precisely the role of the judge, and it is precisely the role of the jury to make that determination at the end of the day. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pulvers. Before we take questions, let's see. Representative Shields, did you want to go ahead and have Ms. Nunley testify at this time,
please?
Ms. Nunley, we're going to go ahead and just make sure we can hear you. Can you tell us your name, please? And we're going to go ahead and put a microphone down here. All right, if you can do that one more time for us.
Pamela Nunley.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Nunley, I hope you've had an opportunity to hear the testimony so far. What we'd like for you to do is go ahead and give us your testimony as it pertains to this bill that's before us, 296.
Okay. Although I didn't write anything out, it's just all more from memory because it's still pretty fresh, even though it's been years since I sat on this trial. And I don't know if you want specifics on who the trial was about or just generic.
Well, I'm going to let you give us your testimony as to what you think is relevant to the proceeding here.
Okay.
I think you understand what the bill would do.
Uh-huh.
And so I personally would like for you to, let's say, focus your testimony on that as compared to, let's say, reliving the trial itself or going into specifics of to what occurred.
Okay. I guess basically in a nutshell, sitting on that jury back then, if I would have known, what possible sentence this boy would have gotten, and if there was a minimum, or we were only directed very specifically that if this indeed happened, he is guilty, you find him guilty, and there was just more that should have been, I think, brought to our attention. I know that myself, along with two other jurors, wrote the judge a letter after the sentencing and after the decision about how we did not believe that this should happen, that he should not have been found guilty, despite what we were told that we had to do. And then I found out later what his sentence was, and it was devastating. It's still devastating to me. to this day, and I think this law would help jurors. I think this would have went a different way had we been given the information of the minimum sentence for this particular offense. I think it would have made definitely a large difference, and I think the outcome would have been totally different.
All right, thank you. Is there anything else that you want to share with us at this time?
No, I just, I hope this goes through, and, I mean, what's done is done, unfortunately, and I honestly feel that this boy's life was basically ruined, because I think if we would have had more information, we could have helped him a lot more.
All right. Ms. Nunley, what I'm going to do is first let me ask you, do you want to stay on the line and listen to the rest of the testimony, or would you like to go about your way?
How long is it?
I can't tell you exactly how long we're going to go. I mean, I'm more than willing to leave this open so you can hear everything. If you don't want to do that, what I will do is ask the panel of senators that are here if they have any questions specifically for you.
Okay.
And so you let me know if you want to stay on the line now. Or
Why don't we go ahead and do questions? I'm at an elementary school, and I have to get back out there.
Okay. I appreciate your time. So
no problem.
Let me just ask colleagues any questions. Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nunley, what was the sentence that was imposed in the case that you're discussing?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know what it was, but I do know that he had to register as a sex offender. And, this was a situation where a boyfriend and a girlfriend had intercourse, and, the child was, she was just below, the minimum age. And so, I don't know what the sentence was itself. I don't remember. I just know that it was way beyond what should have happened.
Thank you.
Ms. Nunley, do you remember what the actual conviction was, what the charge was that he was convicted of?
He was guilty of, I want to say rape, because she was a minor.
Should have been. Yeah.
And he was not, I think he was 17.
Okay, you kind of trailed off on that last part.
Oh, I'm sorry, and she was a minor, and he was 17.
He was 17, and she was, you say, a minor?
I think she was, I'm going to say 14, 15.
Okay, had to be 14,
3
years.
All
right, any other questions for Ms. Nunley? Ms. Nunley, what we're going to do is I'm going to ask you again, do you want me to go ahead and terminate our phone call now, or did you want to kind of listen and take off when you need to take off?
I'm going to go ahead and just take off deal with the kids here.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time and making yourself available this morning.
You're very welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's see. Susan, were you next or Mark?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Good morning, Senator Prezanski and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear this morning. My name is Susan Elizabeth Reese. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in Portland for 35 years. I have a statewide practice based both in Portland and right now in Newport. And I'm appearing on behalf of this bill, which I see is essentially a jury's rights bill. It promotes honesty in jury instructions. And I think that as Mr. Pulvers and Representative Shields have both pointed out, what it does is provide public information to the jury, which the jury is entitled to know and should know in making its determination. I'd like to point out what the bill doesn't do. It doesn't tell the jury what to do with this information. It doesn't instruct them to use it either in mitigation or in aggravation. It simply tells them these are the facts. And one of the reasons that it's important is because, as Mr. Pulvers pointed out, historically the judge has made the sentencing decision, and the judge has based that decision on things such as the offender's past criminal history or absence of criminal history, the wishes of the victim, various aggravating and mitigating factors, the sentencing guidelines, things that the jury wouldn't necessarily know about. And in that context, it makes sense that the court instruct the jury that the sentence is up to the judge. However, Measure 11 changes the balance, and Measure 11 basically says the judge has no discretion. In Measure 11 cases, the judge has to start from the jury's finding of guilt required by statute. So in essence, when the judge is instructing the jury that the sentence is up to me, that's false. And what this bill would do is provide honesty in the instructions so that the jury knows the sentence is up to me except. So what, in fact, that can mean is both favorable to the defense and unfavorable to the defense. I can recall a case recently in which I tried, which involved some pretty egregious facts, and I could envision the jurors saying, boy, I think Measure 11 is appropriate in this case. I hope the judge stacks these convictions up one after the other. There are, of course, situations in which the jury say this is really harsh, and we have to consider carefully whether we're going to find this offender guilty in light of the knowledge that the judge is bound to impose at least the mandatory minimum sentence. What this instruction will do is simply give the jury the added fact, which is already out there, and which they should be able to know about as they apply the law in the case before them. I think that the Thorpe case, if I'm understanding Ms. Nunley's testimony to refer to that case, is one good example in which the age difference was within a few days of the three-year difference that would have allowed a defense for Mr. Thorpe, and he ended up being convicted of a Measure 11 sentence and being sentenced to a mandatory minimum as a result of the jury's findings. My memory of that case is that had the judge been given discretion in sentencing, the victim would have come forward, and her mother, who testified in the case, would have come forward to say, this prison sentence is unduly harsh under these circumstances. So the sentencing discretion that is vested in the judge and taken away by Measure 11 can cut both ways, both for the benefit of the defense and against the defense, both for the victim and against the victim, because in Thorpe, the victim would have said, this is too harsh, and the judge was bound to ignore that in that sentencing. I think the instruction in this bill is consistent with the trend to allow jurors more involvement in the trials. As we've seen in Oregon now, a lot of counties allow jurors to ask questions throughout the course of the case. The judge determines whether the questions can be answered or not, or in what fashion they can be answered in consultation with the attorneys. So the jurors are getting more involved, and they should be able to have more information in front of them, particularly information that is already public record. Everyone over 15 is presumed to know the law as it applies to them under Measure 11. And so this is simply telling the jury what they are presumed already to know. The voters twice endorsed Measure 11, so everyone presumably understands it, is aware of it, and all that this bill does is simply say, it's going to apply in this case. You need to know that. And so I would endorse the bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning.
All right, thank you. And Mark.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I did submit a written testimony. I don't know if it's been distributed to you. If it has, I would just add that, first of all, I would suggest a clarification in Section 1 to use the phrase mandatory minimum term as opposed to punishment, because I think it is accurate in terms of what the bill is attempting to accomplish. And as far as what the bill is attempting to accomplish, it is attempting to accomplish something totally consistent with the movement of the law through the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Apprendi, Blakely, and the cases cited in my written materials, that the jury is the ultimate repository of authority in criminal prosecutions and the decisions that are crucial in determining whether people should be convicted and of what. The Supreme Court in Jones resurrected the history of the role of the jury, reinforced the role of the jury, and then in Apprendi and Blakely granted to the jury and took away from the courts the fact-finding authority that depends or on which sentences depend. In our own state, this legislature, when it adopted the responsibility instruction back in 1983, crossed the threshold of what it was that was appropriate for the jury to know and not know in terms of the consequences of its decision. And the legislature said it is appropriate to tell the jury in a guilty except for insanity case the consequences of a finding of guilty except for insanity. The defense, of course, attacked that because the concern was that a jury, knowing that someone would not go to prison but might be eligible for release through the Psychiatric Security Review Board challenge the constitutionality of telling the jury the consequences of their verdict. And in the Amini case, which is cited in my written materials, the Oregon Supreme Court said that that information had no risk of distortion of the jury's fact-finding decision-making or any risk of to the rights of a fair trial that are guaranteed by the Oregon Constitution. And we've crossed that threshold. So any criticism of this bill based on the fact that jurors, knowing the consequence of their decision, will somehow render an irrational verdict or one not based on the facts, has already been decided. It's been decided by the legislature in enacting the statute and the Supreme Court in deciding Amini that jurors are actually more responsible than that. And in fact, I will say I've been around for a long time. I was a federal prosecutor for quite a few years, and I've been, as I describe my practice, representing people at odds with the authorities for many years since then. And I can tell you, having been involved in various aspects of government in various gadfly ways for many years, the one institution of government that people learn to respect more and come to appreciate more, the more they get to know it, is the jury system. People who serve on juries come away saying how impressed they are with how the system works. People who see the legislature at work or see the courts at work from the outside don't always come away with that same heightened sense of appreciation. And I got to tell you that if we trust jurors to make these life and death decisions, or in Measure 11 cases, mandatory sentencing decisions, if we trust them to make the basic decision, we ought to be trusting them to not misuse information about the consequences of their decision. Every day we make decisions based not just on the facts in front of us, but on what the consequence of a wrong decision would be or a right decision. If you don't have that information, if you don't know what the consequence of your decision is, how can you know how carefully you need to consider your decision? That's all this bill does. It tells people the consequence of its decision, what we all in our common experience do every day. So I would urge you, with the modification I suggest about the mandatory minimum language, to pass this out of committee with a vote to approve the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Before I open up for questions, I'm going to put a couple of statements up there as the chair. And first of all, I guess, Ms. Pulvers, when you were talking about the I didn't get quite the phrase that she used, but at the end of the day, the jury has to do their duty and do their job. As we know, I think we've all recognized right now, we have a bifurcated process. We determine whether or not a person is guilty before they go into the sentencing. And I understand the part that we're now starting to see maybe a different framework of how sentences are actually to be imposed without that flexibility. But it seems to me that you are asking the jury to take on information that could, in fact, let's say, have impact on the first phase of whether the person is guilty or not guilty. Do you or either the other counsel want to respond to that?
Well, I think it, as both Ms. Reese and Mr. Blackman have said from their experience, it may have an impact both ways. It can cut different ways in different cases, or it may not play at all. But the fact is, for at least 25 years now in this state, that's a threshold that we have crossed. It is constitutional, and it is, seems to me, to be appropriate when the legislature and the people have shifted the authority from the judge to the jury to make that minimum sentencing determination. And as Ms. Reese, I think, aptly pointed out, when the judge tells the jury that sentencing is for me, not for you, that's not true. It's not true in Measure 11 cases. And part of the corrective is to correct that, but the more important corrective is to let the jury know precisely what it's being asked to do. And in that respect, all it is at the end of the day is the judge instructing the jury as to what the law is, and that is a neutral statement of the law of the state of Oregon, period.
All right. Let me put out there also about the criminal record. Some of you have kind of talked about that may not be appropriate. And I guess why wouldn't it be appropriate, especially when you're looking at some of the cases? Some of them right now have enhancements that do require that, and of course they're going to have that information either being stipulated to or it's going to be coming in as part of the case. But do you not think that they should also have that information, which is also public information?
Permit me to start with the constitutional, and then I'll slide over. The Oregon Constitution entrusts to the jury the finding of facts in civil and criminal cases. Judges do not instruct juries on facts. An individual defendant's criminal history is a fact. The Measure 11 sentence is the law. The judge's office is to instruct the jury on the law. The judge is prohibited constitutionally from instructing the jury that this is a fact, which is what you're suggesting ought to be done in the case of a criminal history instruction. In addition, the law already provides for circumstances in which a defendant's criminal history may be introduced during the course of the trial as a fact in limited circumstances for limited purposes. And consequently, the law already has dealt with and understands the extreme prejudice that can come from the introduction of somebody's history that may or may not be germane to the case in front of the jury. And the law recognizes that the primary function of the jury is to make the decision in the case in front of it. But it would, in my view, be unconstitutional for a judge to instruct the jury that this is a fact.
All right. Let's see, the other thing I wanted to just ask...
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one thing. We have this weird anomaly in the law right now, which I think accounts for that, which is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, and I think it's called Almendarez-Torres, which is an exception to the jury's role in fact-finding as to prior convictions. So the jury, as a matter of constitutional law now, has the responsibility to make all the fact-finding with respect to facts that might enhance a sentence, except with respect to a prior conviction. Almendarez-Torres simply says, that's just a matter of record, there's nothing for the jury to have to anything to do with, and therefore, that is not something to be submitted to the jury. And a sentence can be enhanced by a judge based on criminal history without a jury finding. So, that's really the context in which this is happening, and I think it's not pertinent to the issue that we're discussing here today.
Okay. Ms. Reese, counsel and I were listening, and I guess I wasn't sure if I heard your testimony correctly regarding the individual, and I thought you said that their conviction was a rape three. And if it was a rape three, I guess the question is, how would that play into this bill since rape three is not a Measure 11 offense?
Chairman Przanski, I'm not sure what the specific offense was that Mr. Thorpe was convicted of. My memory was that it was sex abuse in the first degree, but I don't recall. I do know it was a Measure 11, that it was within Measure 11 because of the age difference that was not sufficient to provide a defense, and it's my understanding that the mother and the victim both testified that they felt Measure 11 was inappropriate. They did not feel a crime had occurred, and the state offered the testimony of an expert who said that this youngster is going to suffer the effects of this incident for the rest of her life, and it was a crime and so forth.
Okay. The last thing I want to ask you about was something curious to me as to the jurors' involvement in the Q&A. Could you kind of just, I mean, I'm just not familiar with courts allowing juries to have that type of dialogue during the trial of question and answers as a participant in with witnesses.
What the judges, in my experience, have done is instruct the jurors at the beginning of the trial that they have the right to ask questions, that they need to put the questions in writing and submit them to the court, and that the court will then, in conference with both counsel, determine if an answer is appropriate, and if so, what answer. And so that has meant everything from questions during the examination of a witness through questions during, obviously, the jury's deliberations. And in my experience, what's occurred is it's helpful to both of the litigants to know how the jurors are thinking and the concerns that they're raising. Sometimes it's frustrating for the jurors because, particularly if it's an evidentiary question that's already been decided adverse to one party or the other, the court then says, I'm sorry, I can't answer your question, but thank you very much. Sometimes the judge will say, you know, we've agreed and this particular fact needs to be addressed, and so asks the question of the witness on behalf of the jury.
All right, thank you. Open up the panel for other questions or comments. Senator Boquist.
I have a question for our counselor. On staff measure summary, it says functions of the court and jury. Is this the actual block of instruction that's normally given now?
That is a portion of the uniform criminal jury instruction that is given at the closing of the trial prior to the jury. So hearing closing arguments and deliberating, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, counsel.
Any other? Senator Boamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was Roy who made the point that obviously on some juries there are people who have this knowledge, whether it be because they're an attorney or because they read all the voters' pamphlet statements or for whatever reason, there are people who actually know this information who are on juries currently. And I wonder, it's probably anecdotal, but I wonder if any of the practitioners could comment about whether that does make a difference in the cases that you see in the results. I mean, are you probably aware of the backgrounds of the people who serve on the juries, and does it make a difference when it's somebody who is likely to have this knowledge and about Measure 11 sentences?
Mr. Chairman, let me say that I have no personal experience. Lawyers aren't allowed to talk to jurors in this state. It's a prohibition. So we never find out anything about what the jurors did or didn't know, think, discuss about. All we really know are the anecdotal stories about jurors being shocked at the consequences of decisions that they've made after the fact. Those anecdotal stories are fairly common, but in terms of whether some jurors actually knew and it affected their deliberations, I'm not aware of any information about that at all.
Let me just put out on the record that one of the things that you would know during Vertar is you have a questionnaire that the juror, prospective juror, has filled out, which gives you some information, and you may know, or you could maybe make some assumptions from that as to what their knowledge may be. I mean, that would be something that's given, especially if they're an attorney. The prosecutor and the defense will be looking at, you know, what type of practice do they do, and that will sometimes steer them as to whether they want that person to serve or not to serve.
Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, if I can just address that briefly, I agree with Mark that we're not entitled, unfortunately, to speak with jurors, and that would be something I'd like to see remedied in Washington, where I also practice. We can talk to them. But anecdotally, I know from speaking with voters, parents, and friends of clients that there is a widespread ignorance about the effects of Measure 11. And when folks understand that it's a mandatory minimum, no matter what, they are sometimes quite horrified to determine there's no mitigating factor that a judge can consider. The absence of a prior record is irrelevant. The defendant's age is irrelevant. The defendant's work history and family ties and so forth. So I think it's important that the jury, who, as Mark said, makes these decisions, understand the consequences.
Sure. All right, I'm going to let counsel do this, then I want to move to our next panel unless we have other questions. Okay, first counsel and then Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'm going back to the question I asked counsel from, and Senator Bonamici just raised this. I've had the distinct pleasure of, since I've been in the three terms I've been, to have been called three times to jury duty. And I've never gotten to the point of having this issued because in each case, after sitting for hours in the jury pool with, you know, 40 of my closest friends, which counselors can't come and talk to, it's always gone out the window or gone out the door, or they've negotiated a settlement or they've done something of that. But I'm looking at the line here that says, do not allow bias, sympathy, and prejudice in any place in your deliberation. And frankly, Mr. Chair,
I don't know a single person in this nation that doesn't have a biased sympathy or prejudice, and this looks like nothing but legal speak to me, because regardless, we all take our human nature with us to this place, and I'm kind of surprised to see this statement in here, and it kind of does remind me that, no disrespect, I'm sure the lawyers must have wrote this or the judges wrote it, because everybody in this room today has something. And when I sat in that jury room, I mean, there were people who intentionally knew they were going to answer or say something so they could get out of jury. There were people who were all over the entire spectrum. So I am just surprised looking at this and then say that, well, we're not going to consider what the defense or what the potential charge is, because we get to deal with prejudices and biases and sympathy all day long at every hearing we're in.
Right.
And we're all human.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Yes, thank you, Chair Prusansky. Mr. Blackman, in your written testimony on the last page, in your conclusions, quoting Blakely, in part it says, the very reason the framers put a jury trial guarantee in the Constitution is that they were unwilling to trust government to mark out the role of the jury. Could you put that in a little context, please?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the context from that quote was a historical recitation of the struggle of the executive branch and the judiciary to control the prosecution and consequences. And what the court was saying is that back at the time of the framing of the United States Constitution, there was a very active debate about the role of the jury and a very conscious decision made
reserved to the jury
not to trust the judges or legislatures except for the general framework and maximum sentencing exposure, the power to make decisions that affected people's freedom. There's also a discussion about how in the colonial times, which was, of course, the context of all this, that it was only the jury system that allowed the public will to assert itself. And the most famous case of the time, of course, was the sedition prosecution of John Peter Zenger, who published truthful statements critical of government, was prosecuted because that was, of course, a crime, and the jury acquitted. And the jury acquitted because he, truth, though it was not a defense, was in fact a moral defense. And the Supreme Court recognized in these cases that the jury's moral obligation to do justice was the thing that was being preserved by preserving to juries the ultimate power that we're talking about here. So I think that's the context.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all very much. I'm going to bring up our next panel, Dan Norris. And then I have Eric Blaine, who also wanted to give testimony. Why don't y'all two come up? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 296? Dan, why don't you get started?
Thank you, Chair Prusansky. I'm Dan Norris. I'm a district attorney in Malheur County and president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I don't know what effect this bill would have in terms of jury verdicts. Ms. Polf, and I hope I don't pronounce her name, Ms. Polners, who was up here just a minute ago, she made the point that it may go against a defendant in a particular case. I know when I do the Rotary Club circuit, when I tell them what the sentences are, the usual response is that all they got? But I'm concerned about this as a matter of policy, not that it's going to hurt a particular Measure 11 case or not going to hurt a Measure 11 case. The policy that we have in our jury system is they're entitled to all relevant information regarding guilt or innocence. We do not let them have information about the past sexual history of a victim. Now, if the goal is honesty in jury instructions or transparency in the court system, maybe that information ought to come in. But for policy reasons, we are not going to trash a victim's reputation in the courtroom when they're a victim of sexual assault. And it's not relevant to guilt or innocence on a particular crime. And we don't tell the jury that. We don't tell them about the bad acts of the defendant because it can unduly prejudice their deliberations. We don't tell them about privileged material that we know about, even though it's true, because we're preserving a greater social good and it's not relevant to guilt or innocence. If the defendant invokes his right to counsel or her right to counsel, or does in any of the invocations ask for a lawyer, we certainly are not going to punish a defendant and tell the jury that they invoke their rights because it has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. And part of the justification that I've heard the proponents of the bill is they really need the information to determine whether or not the punishment is just in a particular crime. First of all, that has nothing to do with guilt and innocence. Second of all, that opens up the absolute need for the jurors to know in advance what the person's criminal history is. Because someone with four rapes on their conviction and subject to a Measure 11 offense, I imagine that a jury would say, I need to know what they've done in their life in order to determine whether or not that is a just punishment or not. And even as a prosecutor, I'm unwilling to cross that line, that we're going to blur the distinctions between guilt and innocence for a specific crime and having jurors convict someone because of their past behavior and not because of their behavior in this particular incident. And I am concerned that what this is a jury nullification bill. We're going to give this information to juries in the hope that they will use it in the way that Ms. Nunley said she would have used the information. I can appreciate the fact that she was concerned that this young man had to register as a sex offender. We don't know enough about the facts, but if it was a Measure 11, there's a lot more to it than where we're at, because if he was only 17, the victim had to be quite young to fit within Measure 11. But in her own words, she would have acquitted, not because he didn't commit, not because he was innocent or didn't commit the crime, but because she didn't feel the punishment was appropriate. Now, we can have a debate, and we are going to continue to have many debates over whether or not Measure 11 is an appropriate punishment. And I certainly have enjoyed those discussions over the years. But that's where the debate needs to be, not in an attempt to ingrain jury nullification into a statute. And Senator Boquist mentioned bias, prejudice, or sympathy. My concern is if we intentionally introduce jury nullification into a statute, we're going to have impermissible sympathies and biases coming forward. I don't know what effect it's going to have, but you could have a disproportionate effect on minorities or other protected classes, and it's a slippery slope that is too dangerous to go down. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Eric.
Chair Kazansky, members of the committee, my name is Eric Blaine. I'm a law student at the University of Oregon School of Law. And this winter, I've been fortunate enough to work with Senator Bonamici, although I am not here on that in that capacity. In 1994, the Arizona Supreme Court composed a panel to address issues related to reforms of jury trials. The panel recommended a number of different reforms, including allowing jurors to take notes during trial, and allow jurors to ask questions of witnesses in court proceedings. One of the recommendations for jury trials that this panel issued was to allow the juries to be informed as to the potential sentences for criminal prosecutions in a manner that is very similar to 296. A minority report was issued arguing that this was an unnecessary reform. And unlike most of the other reforms that were recommended by this panel, the Arizona Supreme Court adopted the minority's position that this was unnecessary to go forward with jury trials. The argument in favor, the panel said, was that juries already take into consideration what they think the possible sentences might be. An example provided by the author of the report were in minors prosecuted for vehicular batteries. Juries might consider that the minor who is or is not guilty, let's say the minor is guilty, might go to prison for a long sentence and feel that that sentence is unjustified given the age of the defendant, and therefore find the defendant not guilty despite their own belief that the defendant was guilty. The minority argued that this assumes a higher standard of the reasonable doubt for more severe crimes like vehicular battery, and that there is no precedent for that in American legal tradition. I'm not here to argue for or against the bill, but I thought I would come here today and see if I could provide some information which you might not already be aware. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for anyone on the panel? All right, thank you all very much for coming forward. All right, that's going to conclude our hearing on Senate Bill 296. I'll close that hearing. What I'm going to do is go into some work sessions since we have a number of people here looking around the room as to who might want to be moving to other, let's say, hearings or whatever else. So the first one we're going to open up is Senate Bill 570. And Council? No. My understanding is what is before us is the Dash 3 amendments. I understand that we cannot move the bill out of the committee because we don't have the actual fiscal for the Dash 3s. But what the Chair would like to do is go ahead and get the Dash 3s adopted if the committee is willing to do so, so we can at that point move forward. Senator Boquist and I have served on the work group that has been made up of ourselves as well as Representatives Olson and Representative Barton. And the Dash 3s basically follows the Dash 2s if you've had a chance to review those. The only change with the Dash 3s is that there was a loophole or a perceived loophole for individuals who may be stealing catalytic converters that they could actually take those and sell them at a scrapyard for automobiles. And the bill provides for an exemption from those people, those licenses, from not being under the preview of the bill, and so this kind of closes that loophole, so those type of transactions can't occur, and hopefully we'll keep that type of, let's say, available market from being there. So,
Senator, for the Dash 3s into SB 570.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 3s into Senate Bill 570. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll go ahead and we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 570, but at the same time, we're going to carry it over until this Friday, April 10th. And the reason for that is to hopefully the paperwork that we need to be with the bill will be able to be completed if everyone's back from being sick. So with that, it's carried over until March 10th. And let's see. Regarding the Senate Bill 310, I'm going to just open this up for the purpose of carrying this bill over till also Friday, March 10th. So Senate Bill 310 will be carried over till March 10th. And then that's going to bring us up to the Senate Bill 87. And I don't think I put this on the record yet. And so what I'm going to do is go ahead and carry this bill over until March 10th as well. Again, we're waiting for the paperwork for that bill to catch up with it. And then this will now open up our last hearing that we have. This is on Senate Bill 686. I'll open up a public hearing on that bill.
Senate Bill 686 expands the crime of private indecency to include exposing one's genitals in view of a place where a victim has a reasonable expectation of privacy with the intention of being seen by the victim. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement of this bill.
All right. So, Katie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County here this morning on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Senate Bill 686 would expand the private indecency statute to allow us to prosecute offenders who expose genitals, not only if a person, and I'll refer to the victim, is in a private place, but if they're in view of a place where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy. The public indecency statute, kind of the more common statute that we deal with, I guess I'll begin with that just by way of explanation. If a person is in a public place or in view of a public place, and another person exposes, among other things, exposes their genitals, that is the crime of public indecency. Private indecency was the statute that was passed in 1999, so that if we were talking about a place where a person had a reasonable expectation of privacy but still wasn't in a public place or within public view, it would still be unlawful for another person to expose their genitals to them. And typically, we were looking at situations where this was an individual's private residence. Maybe they were having a party and someone exposed themselves to them. I know it sounds a little bit strange to use that as an example, but we did have cases where that would occur. And in fact, the statute defines fairly broadly, but gives examples of what a place where another person has a reasonable expectation of privacy would include. It would include residences. It would include yards of residences. It would include working areas and offices. One other example that I know from talking with prosecutors in my office, they've had situations where locker rooms at school, again, not a public place, but it is a place where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy and others are exposing themselves to them. What this bill hopes to do is capture that situation where essentially the victim, if you will, and the offender are not both in the private place. A specific example that happened in Washington County, which ultimately ended in the inability to prosecute the offender, was a person who resided in an apartment complex. They were within their own residence, but they could see their neighbor in a neighboring yard exposing themselves to them. It doesn't change the fact that the exposure has to be with the intent of arousing the sexual gratification or intent of one of the people, and it doesn't change the fact that someone has to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the area where they are seated. What this does is, as the statute indicates, the person is in a place or in view of a place where another person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. So in other words, the victim and the offender don't necessarily have to be in the same place. The victim can actually be in a different place in their own residence, but still within view of the area where the person is exposing themselves. So what we see this bill as doing is, if you will, closing a loophole that will still allow us to prosecute these offenders and protect members of the public from this type of indecency.
Okay. Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Counselor, the bill we have says person. The staff measure summary says is all male. Is this male and female? Is this male only? What are we addressing here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, we are addressing persons. The statute does not reference specific gender. From anecdotal experience, it is more typical that the defendants in this situation are in fact male, but they could be female. And the statute does not differentiate between what gender the offender could be.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And since the good senator at the other end has got the book in front of him and I can't read it up, I'm assuming that genitals or the definition in the bill is, of course, bisexual or male-female or whatever we're calling it, because I don't have the statute in front of me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the statute doesn't specifically define genitals. It just uses the word genitals. And again, these amendments don't change that language in the existing statute. But that obviously it would be the genitals of either a male or female.
Mr. Chair, thank you, but I don't have the existing statute sitting at the other end. That's what I was asking you. I'm assuming it
he'll share with you.
You have it now.
Thank you.
Well, just thought you might want to follow up after you've looked at the definition. So.
Well, the counselor said there was no definition
right
in here. So. I'll trust to you, counselors, that it's both sexes.
It is both. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And that's the only person I have scheduled that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 686. Anyone else? Going once? Going twice? All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. And I believe that takes care of the work that we had on today's agenda. Is there anything else, Council, that we need to cover? All right, so with that in mind, as I mentioned, this is a reminder, we do have a committee meeting on Friday morning. It will be at 8:30. Hopefully it will be more just cleanup with hopefully numerous work sessions to clear out the bills that we need the paperwork on. There are a couple other bills that are on the schedule for that day. And then for those who can make arrangements and choose to make arrangements, there will be an informational hearing on Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock on the HOPE program. But again, members will be excused if you have other obligations that are going to take you out of the Capitol. With that, we're adjourned till tomorrow at 8:30.